Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Human blood has sometimes been compared historically and sociologically to a river that defines human society over the millennia. That river has been charted in a recent book and television series entitled Blood, An Epic History of Medicine and Commerce by Douglas Starr. This work traces the history of blood in medical, political, and economic terms from the earliest days of bloodletting to the era of AIDS and the international control of blood and its products. I spoke with Douglas Starr by phone from his home near Boston, Massachusetts, and asked him to begin our conversation by telling us how he transformed a book that took 6 years to write into a television series.
Well, I've got to give credit to the producers of Channel 13 in New York. It was very interesting. My book took 6 years to research and write. It took research in 9 countries and 7 languages because blood is really a global resource with a global history. Several people had approached me after it came out, and the producers at Channel 13 very much impressed me with their ability to take science and medicine and make it into captivating drama. One of the things you find in going from book to television is obviously you can't get it all in. You know, the book takes more than 4 hours to read, and television is a visual medium as opposed to an informational medium. So it was fascinating to see how some of the chapters were transformed into a visual expression that really made sense. Along the way in researching the book, I'd every once in a while see something and say, oh, they must have this on television. And fortunately, they were able to get that and more. So I've got to say, by taking the core ideas of the book and some of the core characters, you can't fit it all, and putting it on television with captivating pictures and music, it all came together in a very good way, I think.
What I'd like you to do is tell us about some of the history of blood in other countries. Most of us know about the folklore legend of George Washington and leeches, but what about how blood has been treated in other places around the world?
Well, it has been something revered for all of human history and in virtually every country. People have associated blood with all sorts of religious meanings, with nationalistic meanings. There's something special about it. It's just not another part of the body. As you know, through history, people have used bloodletting as a way to cure disease and help injuries, even though there's never been any evidence that it did any good. This was something done from Greek civilization to the Egyptians, to the great Arabic physicians, to the Chinese, to the Indians. It's still done in parts of India today. It's fascinating. Interestingly enough, after World War II, when it became very clear that blood was a resource that every nation should marshal, when the International Red Cross went to certain nations, they found a lot of resistance because of lingering superstition.
And then if we move forward 50, 60 years after World War II, the problems with blood are much more restrictive, talking about AIDS in particular.
Yeah, that was a terrible tragedy. The blood supplies got contaminated with a virus that people didn't know that was there. When the first glimmers of this problem began to show, people moved slowly. Some argued that the blood industry moved too slowly. And then when they figured out how to start screening people and eventually how to screen the virus, they did that. One of the differences between this country and others is even though in this country one can argue whether people move fast enough, in other countries there were actually active cover-ups. And in France and Japan in particular, the health officials actually covered up the information from patients, and as a result of that willful negligence, a lot of people got sick.
You mean they knew that blood was contaminated and they chose to keep silent?
Pretty much. In France, there was a situation in which factor VIII, which is the liquid that people with hemophilia use, they inject it so that their blood clots, you know, in a more normal rate. That's managed by the government. And even after they knew that all of their stocks were contaminated with HIV, they kept distributing to people because they didn't want to waste the money of throwing it out. Similarly, in France, after an American company came up with an AIDS test kit so they could test blood for HIV, the French delayed the entry of that kit onto the market so that the test kit manufactured by the Pasteur Institute could get to the market as well. It was even worse in Japan, where some of the chief doctors who managed hemophilia patients actually told them the stuff they got was absolutely fine when they actually knew the patients already were HIV infected, and some of them went on to infect their wives. So there's a real spectrum of how various countries reacted to the crisis.
Do you think these cover-ups were done for economic reasons, or were there social or religious reasons?
I think you, believe it or not, you've really nailed it. It was all of the above. In France, part of the cover-up in terms of distributing the bad factor VIII was done for economic reasons. But another part of it, in which they neglected to ask donors certain embarrassing questions, were kind of for nationalistic reasons. I mean, ever since World War II, the French have revered blood. And to them, it's just not a pharmaceutical, but the act of giving blood has always been one of the social bonds that network their society together. To the extent of that, in France, they even got blood donations from prisoners. They thought this was a redeeming social thing to do. And when the word came out that a lot of this blood might be infected, they couldn't bring themselves to ask donors embarrassing questions, and it took them years to stop collecting blood from prisons, even though it turned out that this stuff was wildly infected. So you've got this, in Japan, it was partially economic and partially their paternalistic system of doing medicine at the time, in which it was the physician knows best, and he'll tell you what he thinks he needs to know. So just like everything else in this history, the way nations responded to the HIV crisis was a mixture of economic, political, nationalistic, religious, and superstition.
Do you have any theories on how HIV came to the human species?
No, I think I kind of go with the mainstream that I guess they say it somewhere in Africa it made the jump, but I don't go with any of the exotic theories.
You talk about blood wars in your book.
Yeah.
Tell us about those blood wars and what the point is that you're getting at there.
Well, I assume you're talking about the period of World War I, Spanish Civil War, and World War II.
Right.
Yeah. It's very interesting that a lot of the key developments of the modern blood bank took place just before the World Wars, in other words, just before the bloodiest period in human history. And we had Karl Landsteiner figuring out blood types, Richard Lewison figuring out clotting, how to keep blood from clotting so you could save it. You had the Soviets figuring out putting blood in bottles and saving it, and then being adopted by the Americans and the British and everybody else. And then it hits, and it hits the fan. And we've got World War I, horrible, horrible spilling of blood and destruction and death. And some experimentation with transfusion on the battlefield, not that much, but a bit, taken back to civilian life. Spanish Civil War, and those doctors are starting to take blood in this technology, putting it in bottles. A Canadian physician went over and got a van and started running a mobile blood service, speeding blood to the front lines. And then, of course, you've got World War II, the greatest bloodletting in history, and also the greatest mobilization of blood. And it was World War II in this nation when the government and private people and doctors kind of stitched the whole nation together in this big production apparatus for collecting and producing blood and its byproducts and shipping it around the world. And this was really the flowering of blood as a national health system and as an industry.
Retrospectively, knowing what we know now about blood, what kinds of mistakes were made in those times, in World War II, for example, about transfusions that were given from one person to another, when all they really had to go on were the several different blood types?
Well, it's a lot more complicated now. I mean, you know, in World War I, interestingly enough, they had what's called donor on the hoof. They didn't even have blood banks, really. They had a few, but nothing significant. And what they would do is they'd call you in, check your blood type, and if you're compatible, then they would actually connect you. They would lead a catheter from your arm into the arm of the recipient directly, or sometimes past a little pump. They'd pump on this piston. And it's horrifying to somebody of our period. In World War II, it was still used as a blunt instrument. I mean, they had blood types, they screened for syphilis, and that was it.
Well, when they used the system that you describe in World War One, what were some of the problems that arose from that?
Well, it was hard to get sterile conditions, and the blood would clot and clog up the machinery, and sometimes, you know, people would react to the minor subtypes, and pumping blood in under pressure isn't always the best idea. You know, sometimes taking the blood was as traumatic as operating on the patient. It was a very, very coarse tool, but it's all they had. Similarly, in World War II, even though they now have blood in bottles and plasma in bottles, they didn't know about hepatitis. They caused it jaundice. They called it jaundice. And the hepatitis rates were horrific. It was nothing we'd accept now. That's not to say they did it wrong. It's to say they were operating with what they knew at the time.
Well, you said before that there's no evidence that bloodletting of 250 years ago did any good.
Right.
How about the evidence that the type of blood transfusions that you're talking about 80 and 60 years ago, did they do good?
Oh, they did tremendous good. Absolutely. One of the things, I mean, and when we're talking about the transfusions in 1915, 1920, the doctors could see patients seemingly come back from the dead. You know, some of the early transfusions, transfusing blood to a baby that were just dead, and the color just fills up. In terms of World War II, considering that we had transfusions and the Axis powers did not, that must have made the difference in thousands and thousands of lives. It was a very dramatic medical advance.
This week on Radio Curious, we're talking with Douglas Starr from his home in Cambridge, Massachusetts, about his new book called Blood, An Epic History of Medicine and Commerce. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Doug, what turned you on to blood? How did you get drawn to this?
It's interesting. It happened in small steps. I'm a journalist who specializes in writing about science, medicine, and public health. And a friend from Colorado called one day and said he'd heard of a company doing some work in artificial blood, or artificial hemoglobin. And I started looking into that as a possible magazine story. And when I looked into that, I thought, well, I should find out what the market for this stuff is. And I was astonished to find that there was a global market in blood products. And then I thought, well, I wonder what the history of this is. And I found somebody in the industry who'd been working during World War II. And it opened up into this whole amazing tapestry of stories. And the more I pushed on it, the bigger I got. And I realized that human blood is almost a river that defines human society over the millennia. And when I realized it was something that big, I knew it was time to write a book about it.
What do you mean defines human society over the millennia? What are some of the definitions that you've observed?
It's very interesting. When you look at how societies view blood, it's almost the way they view themselves. I mean, take the Greeks. They believed in the four bodily humors that reflected the four elements of the universe. And their whole system of looking at blood reflected a belief of a greater order. If you look at the medieval people, you know, it was a world of swirling mysticism, and their view of blood was mystical. It kind of combined the beliefs of the leaf of the Greeks with that of early Christianity, and they had these something called vitalism, which believed that blood kind of contained the spirit of things as well. If you looked at the Nazis, so utterly perverse in every other way, equally they were perverse with blood. Rather than try to gather it and use it as a resource, they killed or expelled their most eminent medical scientists, and those who were left turned all their attention to studying how an alleged Aryan blood type made them superior when nothing exists, and as a result they had no real transfusion. Every society seems to view blood as the way it views itself. I could say the same thing about Americans. If you look at the way we handled blood since 1900 and certainly into the wars, it was this very practical way of looking at it. You know, we didn't get all caught up with the mysticism of the semi. It's this material. Let's use it. How would we break it down? How do we distribute it? How do you make money off it in some quarters? Very practical. So every society seems to have its own way of viewing blood. And if you step back, it seems to be the way they view themselves.
How would you characterize the American society now in the 21st century based on the way blood is viewed here?
Well, as everything else, it's complicated. We are certainly in the post-AIDS period, so people are still very nervous about blood, even though it's safer than it's ever been in history. Some people, unfortunately, even believe that you might get AIDS by giving blood, which is completely untrue. The blood is very safe. So the collections aren't as high as they should be. People are incredibly cautious. The health officials are cautious. At the same time, the massive outpouring of blood donors after 9/11 showed Americans that they still care and they're still willing to give. And I think the challenge now is, how can you harness that tremendous compassion we have into a way in which people give over a sustained period of time when the system really needs it?
How would you answer that? Answer that challenge as you pose it.
I give a full answer. I should say I wrote an article that's appearing in the New Republic magazine, and one of the things I lay out is to say, I think it needs to be made more convenient. It's still kind of difficult to get to the blood center at the hours they do it. There are other groups we should be taking blood from. There's a group of people with a genetic condition called hemochromatosis, in which their body produces too much iron, and it's the only condition ever known to man in which bloodletting works. They drain some blood out every month. This blood just goes down the drain, and it could be used, and it could be hundreds of thousands of pints of year, and there's nothing inherently wrong with it. We have to use that wonderful American practicality that we're so gifted with and start saying, look, let's stop thinking we're a bunch of selfish creeps. We're as good as we've ever been. How can we start to manipulate the way we live? How can we begin to construct social devices that make it easier and more convenient for people to give? And I think that will utilize the inherent goodness of Americans in a way that makes it work.
Do you have some answers to those questions of constructing the social devices that will make it easier to give blood?
Yeah, I think they need to establish more satellite blood centers so it's easier for people to give. This will not be cheap. I think we do need to accept the fact that medical materials like blood are expensive. I think we do need to take blood from hemochromatosis patients when possible. I think blood centers need to advertise more, and not always we're in a crisis, but sort of on a continual basis. You have to remember that it used to be possible to collect blood from union halls and big factories, and now that we're a service economy, we don't have that anymore. So these are some of the ways that we could take advantage of the way we live today to sort of get the blood collection right out in front of us.
Knowing what we know now about blood compared to what we knew 50, 100, 200 years ago, what do you think we will be able to learn in the next 50 to 100 years about blood?
Well, I think they've certainly learned how to make it very, very safe. You know, there are a lot of questions you face when you give blood, and there are a lot of screening tests. The screening tests are beginning to effectively close the window period. And by window period, I mean that time after which you get an infection but before which it shows in your blood. And that window period is getting smaller and smaller because of tests that actually check the viral DNA. I think that's good. I think people are getting better at preserving blood longer. I think people are working with artificial hemoglobin, which will have an indefinite shelf life. It will never replace whole blood, but it could supplement it in the operating room or in ambulances. So I think people are getting there. I do think that the most enduring mystery of this whole thing is how to get enough.
Yet we all have it.
We all have it. It's just a matter of getting it out into a sort of a community storage facility for when we need it.
Do you see any possibility for trans-species transference of blood?
Well, it's very funny because, as you know, the first transfusion mentioned in the book is this one in 1667, in which one of Louis XIV's doctors had this idea of infusing calf's blood into a madman, thinking that the blood of the gentle calf might calm the man down. So there are certainly historic precedents in a way. What's interesting is some of the companies working with so-called artificial blood are doing that very thing. And one of the companies is taking the hemoglobin out of cow blood, and hemoglobin is the molecule that binds oxygen, and processing it, making it clean, and using it to make an oxygen-carrying substitute for blood. So to that extent of taking a molecule from another species' blood, it's something that will be possible.
Do you think that the possibilities are going to be driven by science or economics?
I think they're inseparable. And one of the things we try to teach at our Center for Science and Medical Journalism is that science is something that takes place in the real world. You know, we'd love to think of it as something on a pillar, but no, it's in the real world. And progress or policy is always determined by a mixture of science, politics, money, and what people want.
This week on Radio Curious, we're talking with Douglas Starr, the author of Blood, An Epic History of Medicine and Commerce. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Doug, is there a section of the book that you would like to read for us?
There's one interesting part, and it comes at the very end of the section on World War II. And as I mentioned earlier, World War II was when the nation really harvested everything it knew about blood, from breaking it into plasma to albumin to whole blood, and they shipped it to the Pacific for the invasion of Iwo Jima. This was the penultimate use of blood. And there's one section after the Marines have reached the summit of Iwo Jima in which I kind of reflect on what blood meant for them and what blood meant for our society. And if you like, I could read that.
Yeah, would you please?
Okay, as I say, they've just planted the flag on top of Iwo Jima. And I say, this was but one of many heroic spectacles, not only on Iwo Jima, but throughout the Pacific. Carl Meidens, a photographer for Life magazine, wrote of the icon-like image of, quote, combat medics bouncing jeeps who, holding on with one hand, raise the other high as one would a torch, holding a bottle of plasma pouring life back into a broken body. I think I've never seen a soldier kneeling thus who is not in some way shrouded with a godlike grace and who did not seem sculpted and destined for immortality. Marine Corps Sergeant Myers described the gritty endurance of corpsmen lying on their backs in foxholes, quote, holding plasma bottles up over their heads until their arms grow numb. They sit on careening jeeps and trucks, holding their bottles aloft, while wounded leathernecks fight for their individual battles of life en route to the rear areas. And there are more bottles of blood, he said, whole and plasma lashed to poles and on upended rifle butts at the grim way stations along the beaches. General Kendrick, the Army's transfusion chief, described another scene on an unnamed island in the Pacific in which a wounded man lay in a depression directly under the line of fire of a Japanese machine gun. Quote, to leave him without treatment would have meant his going into irreversible shock. To move him would have meant certain casualties for the litter squad. A staff sergeant, who was later awarded a Silver Star for bravery, crawled out to him, dressed his wounds, splinted a fracture, and then administered 3 units of plasma to him by lying on his side and elevating a bottle of plasma in one hand. Closed quote. Something symbolic was happening to blood, although it may have not have been clear to the medics at the time. For even as they worked, bullets and shrapnel zipping around them, they were taking part in a transmutation as elemental as any that had come in the centuries before. In every epoch, people had seen blood as more than it really was, more than a liquid or a component of their body, but as a reflection of their image and understanding of themselves. To the ancients, powerless in a frightening world, blood became a symbol of the potency they desired. The Greeks, as we have seen, looked at blood as a reflection of the universal order, one of the 4 bodily humors that so perfectly mirrored the balance of nature that an excess of the substance was presumed to cause illness. Their Christian descendants imbued blood with spirit, infusing it with the qualities of the creatures in which it flowed. Medicine changed drastically in the late 19th century, shifting from humors to germ theory, yet despite its increasingly practical use, blood retains its mystical resonance. The early Soviets saw blood as an expression of the collective, the Spaniards as a covenant between a people and their cause, and the Nazis, perversely, as the literal and figuratively embodiment of racial purity. Now blood would reach another level of allegory, forged in history's most murderous conflict, at once uplifting and practical. For the Americans were imbuing blood with their own kind of metaphor, not of the magic or potency above, but of their own power, inventiveness, and humanity. Theirs was a typical practical symbology, not the lofty social contracts of the French, but a pride in their competence to develop and use a resource. After all, the Americans processed blood into more products than everyone else. As blood, plasma, and albumin, and as the host of pharmaceuticals that emerged from Edwin Cohn's lab. Indeed, they used blood in such a large quantity and in so many forms that strange little coincidences began to occur. In a hospital in Paris, a Corporal Kenneth L. Johnson received plasma that turned out to have been donated by General Dwight D. Eisenhower. The corporal has the blood of a general, read a caption of a newspaper photograph. In the Pacific, a wounded Navy gunner named Harry Starner was receiving some plasma when, glancing at the bottle, he saw his own name on it. He had donated blood while on leave in Washington, D.C. That infinitesimally small possibility demonstrated just how industrialized, how mastered blood had become. It was the ultimate stage of the liquid's evolution. Blood, once held in religious regard, had been removed from a man's circulatory system, separated, processed, freeze-dried, packaged, shipped, and reconstituted, only to be injected into the same individual in a completely different form several months later and half a world away.
Doug, that's almost like the precursor of blood that's taken from people prior to surgery and then given to them.
Oh, yeah, it's fascinating. You know, it took me 6 years to do the book, as I may have mentioned, in 9 countries, and it was absolutely fascinating every step of the way.
Well, Douglas Starr, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I'd like to ask you to tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately.
There's actually a very interesting book called Instance of the Finger Post by a British author named Ian Bierce. And it actually begins with a blood transfusion in the 1600s. It's a murder mystery, and it's told in 4 different voices. And it's the same story told, and each time you gain more and more insights into it, and it is impossible to put this book down.
Well, Douglas Starr, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
Douglas Starr is the author of Blood, an epic history of medicine and commerce. The book that he recommends for us to read is Instance of the Finger Post by Ian Bierce. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious are available at cost for $10 each. I'll give you the address in just a moment. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your cards, letters, suggestions, and ideas for future programs. Here's the address. Radio Curious, Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. The phone is 707-462-6541, and the email is curious@pacific.net. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Stay curious, be creative, and join us again next week.